everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to the podcast where we try to make you smart on tech, the economy, and culture. We're just trying to keep ourselves, on track at all today. Anyway, today's show is a thing that, as you know, I've been fixated on as this crisis has gone on, and that is because I believe the only story is testing. What is going on with testing? How can we do more?
This is the whole smash, right? Because we need way more than we've got, and there aren't really encouraging signs that we are going to get way more than we've got. So what do we do? Because there's like 330 million people in this country, and we ain't got that many tests. Full stop.
Yeah, and I mean, the numbers are staggering. Like, the gap is staggering. Public health experts are saying we need 4 million to 30 million tests per week. And this is because you cannot manage what you do not measure, right? If you don't know where this thing is, you don't know whether you can safely return to work without creating more outbreaks. As of about 3 weeks ago, we were at 100,000 tests per day. That number has been increasing, but there are a whole bunch of parts of the kind of testing supply chain that make it really hard to get these things out the door.
Yeah.
So
what we did was we got a high school buddy of Molly's on the phone. That's what we did. We got a high school buddy
like
of Molly's on the phone. His name is Lauren Wald. He's making the test as we speak. He's the director of biomedical research at the College of Nursing at Ohio State. Lauren, thanks for coming on the pod.
Thanks so much for having me.
And this is, I just want to say, everybody, this is unrelated to the high school connection. Lauren basically texted me and was like, oh, hey, P.S., we've converted our lab at Ohio State to produce like thousands of tests a day, which caused me to go, wait, what? You can do that? And now you're here. Oh, yeah. So Lauren, you can do that?
You can, surprisingly. We didn't think you could, but we figured it out. It's been a lot of trial by error and learning from your mistakes and consulting a lot of smart people.
So before we get to the manufacturing and the switching over of your lab to do this, which is amazingly cool, right? What are we testing for when we say we have to test for coronavirus?
Mm-hmm. So normally what happens is if a patient has symptoms, they'll call their normal physician who will then order the test. And they'll go to a testing site. Some of them will go to a drive-through testing site. Others will go to a clinic. And a swab will be placed very high up in the nasal cavity. It's called the nasopharyngeal area. And what it'll take is a sample. And what they're sampling is for the live virus. And that sample will then be taken back to the lab. And a test, which is called PCR, or polymerase chain reaction, will actually look for the live RNA in the virus.
Explain to us the difference between the virus tests and the antibody tests, which we're also hearing about ramping up as people try to figure out if they already had this thing.
Correct. So the live virus test is for those who are in an active infection phase. And so they're actually suffering from the virus at that present time. What the antibody test is looking for is those who have suffered and recovered. So their body has produced antibodies. These are the little silent fighters within your body that are there because they fought off that virus. And they're going to stay in your body to prevent further infection. We don't know how long that is, but their antibodies will be present and detectable within the blood.
Are antibodies and antigens the same thing?
So they're actually opposite. So antibodies fight off the antigen. So the antigen in this case, you can assume is the virus itself.
Okay. All right. Good. I'm like learning stuff in real time. Sorry. I got one more thing. So is this hard to do, like science-wise, to test for this thing?
So it's actually not. The test that is normally done, as I said, PCR, is done in almost most researchers' labs. We do it in my lab multiple times a day on a routine basis. So what it's used for is really to look for any genetic material in any type of sample. So in our normal life, when we're not in a pandemic, we look at cardiovascular disease in different animal models, preclinical models. And what we look for example, is we want to see whether a certain genetic piece is present in some sample within our model. Right. And so we do use this test on a routine basis.
Huh. I mean, we're already like, we're getting smarter by the nanosecond.
No, I know. I love this. It's great. It's great.
So there are a lot. Yeah, basically, we were like, there are so many things that we keep hearing about testing, and we just want you to explain. One of those things that we keep hearing about testing is about accuracy. False positives versus false negatives. How accurate are the tests that are sort of bopping around the country? And let's stick to virus tests for now.
Yep.
And how big a deal is it if they're not accurate?
So you can only, so you're only going to be able to get a positive test if you actually have the virus in the sample. The problem is that this swab has to go so far back in the nasal passage that, number one, it's very uncomfortable. Number two, a lot of times it doesn't go far back enough, and therefore the sample will not contain the virus. And so there's actually new research that came out just yesterday showing that sputum and saliva actually has higher viral loads than the swab sample itself. And so that is now something to think about. Could we take just a saliva sample? Could we send tubes to people at their home? Could they take it? So that's actually something we're talking about today. But the accuracy is between 70 and 90%. And the problem is there's several techniques that must be done in concert and done properly in order for the sample to actually be read accurately. And so when the sample is taken, it has to be put into a tube that contains media, or what we call reagent, and that's sterile. If it's not, if for some reason the sterility was compromised, foreign material could actually be introduced, and that would cause a false positive. Right. So you just have to be very careful. There's so many steps. And the problem is that what you're measuring is RNA, and RNA is very fragile. And so if the time that it takes to do the sample is too long, you could actually compromise the sample. So it's a very coordinated process.
So two things. One is, I don't know if anybody listening to this has ever seen a video of somebody getting one of these nasopharyngeal swab things going, but honestly, that's the stuff of my nightmares, man. Just having something shoved up there until it makes my brain tickle. That's just terrifying. So if you could do a sputum test, sign me up. I'll take that one.
Right.
So why then is it so hard? I guess it's a manufacturing thing, right? To get these testing kits with appropriate sterility and at appropriate scale to get all 330 million Americans, let alone the 7.5 billion people on the planet, appropriately tested, right? It's a manufacturing process logjam.
Yeah. So the problem is that there's many different parts that make up the kit. And the suppliers who make the parts, they're all different suppliers. And so, for example, the reagent that's used in the test tube where the sample is put in and it stabilizes the sample until it can be taken to the lab for the test to be run, the supplier is on indefinite back order and for the reagent. Yeah. So most places that need it can't get it. So colleagues of mine at Ohio State developed their own reagent that actually seems to work better than the commercially available. So that was one piece that was taken out of the equation. The problem now that we're facing is actually the tubes. And so the tubes that the sample is placed into, a majority of the suppliers are from Asia and from Europe, which we know their production was shut down. And so we're facing real difficult times of getting the actual test tube. And we placed an order for 1 million tubes, and we were told we will get them when they can supply them. So it's really difficult at this point to actually know when we're going to get the tubes. So we're filling them as fast as we get them.
Wow.
Yeah. Are we at a point where any of these things, let's say tube production, so because I feel like we keep hearing of this kind of collection of efforts, disparate efforts. One lab is doing this, one lab is doing this. The Ford plant is creating this, some other manufacturing plant is creating that. Like, would it be useful if at some point one company, one manufacturing facility in the United States was just redirected to only make tubes? Or are we like past that?
Yeah, so I think it actually, to have a coordinated effort where multiple facilities use the same plants to make the same exact swab and produce the same exact tube that was sent to everyone would be fantastic. Part of what I'm hearing from the suppliers is they're lamenting that they've had to lay off a bunch of their employees and say that they don't have the people that they can bring back in. And it's actually more expensive to reopen the plant and redirect into this without having governmental support. And that seems has been a challenge to actually get the government to redeploy the efforts to get this job done. Hmm.
So you are the trained professional in the field of the moment, and obviously you've got experience that certainly Molly and I don't have. How long do you suppose it's going to be until we can get adequate testing going on?
So I think that we're going to be at a point where we can test, speaking for Ohio, with our population of 10-ish million, we're going to be able to do around 150,000 per week within the next month. We are not seeing those numbers of people coming to get tested, but we're going to, now that businesses are starting to reopen, we're doing mass testing of the inmate population and guards, which was a big issue in Ohio, of nursing homes. So I think that we're going to see testing really ramp up as we start to reopen our states. But the problem is we're going to see this virus is not going to just disappear. And we're going to see a potential resurgence or two as people start to congregate and people start to, you know, not maintain social distancing and proper washing techniques.
What happens, though, also, presumably the more you test, the more you're going to find.
Right.
And so what impact will that have? Like, there's sort of this counterintuitive thing, which is that more testing may cause more freakout, which might not be the worst outcome. Maybe some states could use a little more freakout. But, you know, what might be the impact of that?
So one issue that my healthcare colleagues are facing is they're talking about testing everybody, doing both a live virus test as well as the antibody test. But you're going to get some people who are going to test positive and they're asymptomatic, but they're going to be then out of the workforce. And so we're having to replace them with other workers. And so that just increases the amount of tests that have to be done. There's issues, of course, with businesses that are having trouble making payroll, et cetera. So it's a real difficult process. Do you test absolutely everybody? The only way that you could test everybody in America is if every person who had a PCR machine was willing to do the test. And I just can't imagine that happening.
So you're a man of science, but I'm going to ask you a completely subjective question.
Sure.
What's your fear level about this whole thing?
Great question. So I come from the Midwest, where we try to, you know, not get too afraid of things. I think that, you know, my North Dakota roots tell me that this is a real bad thing and we need to take it really seriously. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I think that, you know, I'm at like a 7. Just because my biggest fear right now is as we start to reopen the economy, people are going to just go back to how it used to be 5 months ago. And unfortunately, the new normal is going to be completely different than the old normal.
Dr. Lauren Wold, Director of Biomedical Research in the College of Nursing and Associate Professor in the Colleges of Nursing and Medicine at The Ohio State University. And just to clarify, all those tests you talk about Ohio doing, are those all coming from your lab?
The majority of, I don't know the exact percentage, but we're doing the majority of all the kits for the state of Ohio, for the medical center, but also are sending samples to New York City and have been collaborating with the government of Ethiopia on testing.
There's no private company that wants to step into this void? And
I mean,
it would be welcomed.
Look, it's a terrible thing to say, right? But this pandemic is a business opportunity, right?
Right. It is.
It would be welcomed, Lawrence.
It would be welcomed.
Yeah, no joke.
Yes, man. That would be that dry, the Midwest understatement that I think we were both raised with. Yep.
That's right. Yeah.
Thanks,
you
Lauren.
Betcha.
Lauren, thanks so much. Truly, I learned a ton. Also, antibodies and antigens are different. I mean, come on, man. Let's make it harder.
Opposite. So the one is the text. Yeah, that's amazing. I know. I mean, I agree. I love it. I love our show. Right. Lauren, this is so great. And by the way, no, everyone, there will be no photos from high school.
Yes. Mm-mm. I was going to bring one and have it in the back, but you can always email me. And
you know, it's chaotic times. Man. I'm sure you forgot. Anyway, okay. Good to talk to you. Bye.
Got
to
go. See you later. Bye. Bye, Lauren. Thanks.
Thank you both. This was great. Lauren. Thanks.
Man. That was awesome. I learned a ton.
Totally. But clearly, right. By the way, most successful person from my high school. This is, you know. Lauren, who is otherwise
company,
when he's not just like
present
supplying.
Company, hello? What about you? You're no slouch.
I mean,
come on.
No, he does like infant cardiovascular research that saves babies and like all the stuff on vaping. Like when they're not producing all of the freaking tests for the entire state of Ohio. What?
Yeah.
He's like a world-class cardiovascular researcher.
That's
no
cool.
big.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Super cool. Okay. So let's look forward here, shall we? And one of the things Lauren was talking about when we open back up, testing is going to be more important because people are going to think it's normal again. If you're in a state that is opening back up, let us know, would you, what it's like, what the vibe is. Are you wearing a mask? Are other people wearing masks? All that good stuff. Send us an email, voice memo, take your pick. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Coming back in a minute.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Before we get to the news fix, we would like to have a sincere and heartfelt moment of thank you. Like, thank you. And we are blown away.
So we said last week, we pointed out that, you know, we are nonprofit journalism. We need your help. Molly and I are standing in front of the microphone, but there's an army of people behind us and we just need everybody's support. And holy cow, did all y'all answer the mail. 639 of you donated to support this show in the past week, which is enormous. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it is really incredible. I mean, our giving director is basically like, I didn't even know this happened in the world. And I was like, oh, honey, welcome to podcasts. Like the greatest communities in media, sincerely, are podcast communities. And Make Me Smart has been that way from the beginning, continues to be that way. It's an ongoing conversation with really smart people, and I feel like we all value each other, and just to see that play out in such an obvious way that is so impactful and meaningful for our organization is like, it really is incredible. Thank you. Thank you. It's incredible.
Alan is in Huntsville, Alabama. Here's what he wrote. He said, I listen to Marketplace, Marketplace Morning Report, Marketplace Tech, and my favorite, Make Me Smart. Kind of Molly, just growing. You kind of like my beard during the stay-at-home order. Amen, Alan. I hear you on that one, although I did shave. So, you know, whatever.
We creep up on you.
I gave up early. Yeah.
There is more information, and you can, you know, also support the show at marketplace.org/givesmart. But mostly in this moment, we just wanted to say thank you. Like, we're incredibly grateful. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. The news. Here we go.
The news. You want to go first?
The news that's on.
You have
on.
Do
I want to go first? Yeah. I think this is really interesting. So there's a little bit of politics in here. Actually, there's a lot of politics in here. There's a little bit of reshaping capitalism, which is one of the things that's been talked about sort of in the abstract coming out of this. And we've talked about it a little bit on this podcast. And then a little bit of honestly pie in the sky. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, congresswoman from the great state of New York, and Elizabeth Warren, former presidential candidate, senator from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, are either going to introduce or have introduced a bill, probably going to because they're out of session, right, which will ban big mergers and takeovers during the pandemic. And I think that's really interesting because on the politics side of it, they're obviously trying to squeeze Joe Biden to the left a little bit more. On the reshaping capitalism, they're talking about protecting workers and not letting big companies get bigger, which has been a theme for the two of them and certainly one of the things we've talked about in this podcast for a long time. And then the pie in the sky part is, of course, it'll never get past the Senate, let alone signed by the president. But I think it's really interesting that these mechanisms are coming out by which we almost might be forced to think about the new shape of capitalism. And maybe I'm just being naive here, but I think that's actually going to be a conversation.
Oh, no, I think, you know, that's I just want to pivot my news fix because there was a piece today that I'm going to sort of like go and find on the fly from The Washington Post that was about how big tech companies are most likely going to come out of this bigger and even more powerful.
Yeah.
And that so far, and like we talked about it yesterday on the Daily Pod, we have seen a phenomenon of sort of like rich get richer and big companies. And
The big banks on Wall Street are bigger now than they were before the financial crisis. Hello?
Exactly. Yep.
Right? You know.
And when you look at the aggregate anger about that phenomenon, which like, you know, you're kidding yourselves if you think that anger doesn't exist in America, has not been existing, did not lead to Trump's election, and will not lead to even more consequences down the road. That is unquestionably the case, and that is exactly the kind of anger that Elizabeth Warren tapped into to get elected to the Senate, to create the CFPB, and to propose bills like this, to point out that, for example, when these big acquisitions happen, a lot of times thousands of workers get laid off. A big company remains, a hedge fund gets a big return, and people lose their jobs. And the short-term result of what we're seeing now might in fact be big getting bigger and probably will be. And what we're going to find out is sort of Kai's ongoing point, which is like, can that be undone?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I don't know.
Yep.
Anyway. All right. What do you got?
I am also interested in this situation with Tyson, the meat producer, who has been closing plants and has been, in retrospect, warning kind of suspiciously publicly about how
there was a full page ad in the Sunday New York Times, right?
About how they're going to have meat shortages. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I am not trying to be cynical here, but it does feel like that those are the kind of warnings that you make really loudly when you want some help or as a bit of a bargaining tool.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, but I do know that an equal and opposite reaction has apparently occurred, which is that President Trump may order meat processing plants to remain open and declare them critical infrastructure. That's being reported in Bloomberg today. Using the Defense Production Act. It is unclear, however, whether that order is going to basically allow Tyson to not have to protect its workers. Part of the reason these plants have been closing is because workers have been getting sick.
Right. They're like hotspots of this virus.
Yeah. And so a cynical person might say, okay, you made a whole bunch of noise about how if you have to close these plants because your workers are getting sick, then there's not going to be meat on shelves and Americans are going to freak out.
Right.
And then you create the impetus for a presidential order that demands that you stay open. But if it doesn't include a mandate about protective gear or, extended cleaning schedules or social distancing, then Tyson's hands are clean.
Right. And to get this back to the politics of this for a second, right, because this crisis is inextricably linked with politics now. The Democrats on Capitol Hill want a bill that would give money to states and localities to protect their budgets. $500 billion is the ask from the Governors Association. Mitch McConnell, leader of the Senate, wants in this bill as a price tag for that. He wants businesses who put their employees back to work to not be liable if they get sick. Mm-hmm. So there's a very interesting little dance happening here in terms of, first of all, the politics of it, but also if the president orders these people back to work and Mitch McConnell gets his way on the bill, then Tyson's and Smithfield, which has been a hotbed of its own, the pork plant in South Dakota, right? Then those companies are okay. I mean, I don't know, at the cost of their workers, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yep.
Not sure I love how that's playing out.
Yeah. So that's the news. Grim as it is. Do you have another one? I saw two, but are you?
No. Same story.
All right.
Two links, okay.
Same story. All right. Very well. Very, very well. So I can now say that's it for the news fix. Check our daily explainers, though, on your smart speaker. Just tell any Echo advice to make me smart. Time to hear now from you.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
As it happens, our first piece of feedback is a very related thing to what we were just talking about. Last week's episode, of course, was worker protections. We asked frontline workers to reach out and talk to us about what they're experiencing at work. Maria Barber is an essential worker at a warehouse in the South, and here's what she says. I work in a warehouse for a global giant. The warehouse is in the South, where humidity and heat affect us sooner than later. We recently had a confirmed COVID-19 case at our facility, and so people are not showing up, even worse than before. We work so stringently hard during our regular 40 hours that coming in for overtime is so difficult. We are also so behind with our orders, as the whole world has pointed out. Those of us who are at work have temperature checks and masks. We also have Clorox germicide to clean our workstations, but everyone doesn't do it. Social distancing has been in place for weeks, but there are still impossible incidents where 6 feet cannot be maintained. Outside of work, I'm trying to follow all the rules. I live alone, but have a great big family of which I'm able to hug none of them. We Zoom on Saturdays. I have a job, a family, and a dog, which I'm grateful for so much, even though I know it doesn't sound like it. I'll just be glad when I can hug my mama.
I apologize for the Molly.
Guys, I'm just absurd. I'm just absurd. Just give me the funny ones. Oh, wait, there aren't any. Okay, next.
Same topic, different listener. Katie Herman is an employment and civil rights lawyer in Northern Virginia. Here's what she says. Thank you for drawing attention to the lack of OSHA protections for essential workers in your recent episode. This has been a prominent issue for me both personally and professionally. Our office receives phone calls every day from workers who no longer feel safe going to work, and it has been incredibly tough to hear what they are experiencing and then explain the disappointingly limited protections available to them. When I received a similar call from my parents, who both work in essential positions in Michigan, the answer seemed easy. Stop going in. Whatever it takes, we'll figure it out. Unfortunately, they didn't have the opportunity to make this choice on their own. My parents stopped reporting to work when my mom tested positive for COVID-19. We are failing essential workers, and mandatory enforceable OSHA protections are an absolute requirement to keep them safe. For some workers, by the time they realize their employers have failed to protect them, it may already be too late. I wish I had a solution to offer to this very serious problem, but drawing attention to it feels like an important first step. P.S., she says. So this message isn't a complete bummer. I'm happy to report that after several long and scary weeks, my mom has fully recovered from COVID-19 and is doing well. Her workplace has since implemented strict protection measures for employees, and she continues to advocate for more. Wow. So there you go.
Yeah. Right. Yep. I would just like to point out, by the way, that Congress is still not in session.
Yeah, well, so they were supposed to come back today, but then the physician of the Capitol said to the leaders of the House, no, it's not safe for you to come back.
It's not
cases
safe. Ironically,
are rising in D.C. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's so funny because they're rising in warehouses, too. That's so. Yeah. I mean, at some point, like this is just hanging out here. And again, if you think this rage is going to dissipate when the pandemic does, hopefully. You have not been paying attention to history. Lastly, we will play a voice memo from listener Brianna McReynolds from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi, Kai and Molly. First off, your perspectives, insight, and humor are like the balm to my chapped soul these days, so thank you for all you do. On Friday's episode, you asked, how are you doing? And Molly addressed the issue of privilege, and I just had to send in my first voice memo. I was laid off last week, along with, I'm sure, a couple million other people. I'm 29 and have been working since the day after I turned 16. And 2 months ago, my job was gainful and secure. Now I'm learning how to navigate the unemployment system while the world navigates a pandemic. The credit score that I've worked so hard to improve threatens to take another beating, and the future has never looked more uncertain. My inner monologue tends to skew towards shame over my privilege. After all, for all of the unknown, I have no mortgage to maintain, no kids to feed, a solid place to live, no family as of yet who has contracted COVID, thank God, and I'm well aware that it could be so much worse. That said, there are many like me who know we are lucky, but are still humans living through an unprecedented nightmare scenario. So I've been trying my hardest to strike a balance between remembering how blessed my situation is and acknowledging some very valid anxiety and this really sucks feelings. I appreciate you reminding us that whatever we are feeling is okay right now, and that slowly, too slowly, we are all going to make it through this crapshoot.
Oh, honey. Yep. It really sucks.
Yep.
It really sucks. You can own that. We all can, for sure.
All right. Make me smart question. Here we go. What is something you thought you knew but found out you were wrong about? This one is not corona-related in the slightest, so you're welcome. Here's poet and writer Kate Baer, who has a new collection of poetry coming out November 10th. It's called What Kind of Woman? Here you go.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Kate in Southeast Pennsylvania. One thing I thought I knew was what it meant to be a poet. I've been reading poetry my whole life, but I thought if you wanted to actually be a poet, you had to be a grad student smoking a pipe in a haunted alley in France. So I stayed in my lane. I wrote short stories. I wrote first-person narrative. I wrote whole novels. I wrote anything but poetry because I knew what a poet looked like. I knew what she wore, what she ate, what she smelled like. Pine needles and the earth bathed in moonlight, probably. And then Mary Oliver died in early 2019, and I started rereading her work and picking up other poetry books written by all kinds of writers. And I thought, you know what? Why don't I just try it? It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be for anyone else. I have nothing to lose by trying. As it turns out, you don't have to be a pipe-smoking wanderer to write poetry. In fact, you can live in the suburbs. You can be a wife, you can be a mother, you can enjoy really unpoetic things like the Taco Bell drive-thru, and wow, it has been the best surprise.
I love that. You can be anything you want.
That is delightful.
Anywhere you want.
That right? is delightful. Isn't that great? Also, I've never wanted anything more than I want to drive through the Taco Bell drive-thru right now. Like, right now. Apologies, producers. I know I'm on deadline after the show ends, but I might have to go to Taco Bell right now.
Is what it is, man. Is what it is.
It is what it is. All right, that is it for our show today. I love that diversion. Thank you. Thank you, producer Sam Anderson, for putting that in there, because how delightful, pine needles and moonlight. If you would like more from us, Make Me Smart has a weekly newsletter every Friday morning in your inbox, so it's not too late to sign up for this week's. It's a fun and informative read. Marketplace.org/newsletters. And of course, we'll be back tomorrow with The Daily Show.
Yep.
Yay.
Yep, yep, yep. Yep.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producer, Ben Hethcote, and our video intern, Ethan Peretz, and writer-producer, Erica Phillips.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed, hello, Kai, by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager around these parts is Deborah Clark. There we go. We ended it right.
Round these parts. I'm emotionally exhausted once again.
I know. It's all right. It's good. It's all good.
It's great. It's great. It's great. It's freaking real.
Yeah.
We have the Holy Grail on this show, which is real human beings and their real stories. Like, that is really, it's a privilege.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.